Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coeus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coeus Institute.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Up the Vibe. And today I'm joined by Jay Anderson, who is the founder and host of Project Unity. Thank you, Jay, for taking the time to join me today. I followed your channel, Project Unity, on YouTube for the last few years, and there's some really great interviews on there. So really excited to speak to you today. How are you doing today?
You are most welcome, mate. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm doing great. It was a bit of a rainy day today, but yesterday was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous in the UK, which is a rare thing. It was nice and sunny, so I went out for a massive hike, and I've basically just been chilling today and doing a little bit of computer work. So yeah, happy to jump on for a talk.
Oh, yeah, great. It has been mixed weather recently, definitely.
You have to start a conversation with a fellow British person by yeah. talking about the rare occasion of sunshine in our country.
Yes, of course. Firstly, I wanted to talk to you about how you became aware of the UFO cover-up and the vast trove of events that have occurred, the mass sightings, the crash retrievals. What's your kind of history getting into this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I came into it in a weird way, I suppose, which is why I've always given a lot of space for the stranger aspects of the conversation that go beyond just the nuts and bolts and the idea of spacecraft and go a little deeper into the psychology and the conscious implications and potential spiritual implications of a subject like UFOs, because, you know, the way I came into the subject was inherently I'm always a little cautious when I say this, but it's the only way I can really describe it, is that I came into it in an inherently spiritual way, through coincidences and synchronicities in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of things kind of clicked into place, and the path that I started going down in life just seemed to naturally end up with UFOs. And there was kind of like this fundamental moment. Before, I was interested in UFOs, and I had been looking into kind of consciousness and quantum mechanics and different types of philosophies and ideas around, you know, like the big picture and stuff. I've always been someone who likes to think about the bigger ideas and implications of our reality. Always been fascinated by that since I was a kid. But there was a moment, I suppose, where my best friend was like, "Hey, you need to watch this this documentary." And there's a whole longer story, I suppose, attached to this, because it also does it's a necessary part of the narrative that I use to talk about my experiences with the phenomena. There was a long journey of things that clicked into place that ended up with me in my back garden trying to project thoughts and trying to coax something into, you know, showing itself, which it actually did. And so this part of the story is also part of that. It's a big component of that, where my friend was like, "Hey, you need to check out this documentary by this guy called Dr. Stephen Greer." I know. And for some people who are not a fan, I get it. But I wasn't in the UFO community at this point, right? And maybe I'd seen a couple of clips or, a little snippet of a documentary, but I'd never sat down and watched anything. So this, you know, my friend was like, "Check this documentary out. It's called Unacknowledged. And I'll give it to Dr. Greer. This was a great documentary." You know, Unacknowledged was really good. Came at it from the national security, black tech kind of aspect of it for the most part. But then near the end is where he suddenly starts talking about this whole thing called CE5, you know, the idea of making some form of contact through a consciousness modality. And I'm just going to clear my throat real quick. Yeah, and that for me was this really interesting moment, because maybe like 2 or 3 weeks prior, before my friend showed me this documentary, I was sitting on my bed, and I guess you could call it a prayer. You know, I'm not a religious person in that sense, but I was just sitting on my bed and kind of saying out to the universe, like, "Oh, you know, I've been been kind of absorbing all this information about different things, about, you know, the implications of universal consciousness and the idea that quantum mechanics and the idea of a simulated universe could be a spiritual aspect of some larger, you know, larger awareness and all this really esoteric stuff. But none of it applies to my life. None of it, none of it actually is helping me. I don't know how to use this. It's all just too esoteric. So I was sitting on my bed and I was like, give me something I can do. Give me something that's real that I can actually do that applies to all this stuff that I've been learning, that kind of makes it real to me, you know, all these concepts. And so I had sat on my bed, made that request basically. And then 3 weeks later, I get shown this documentary where near the end of it, this guy is saying, hey, you can use consciousness to make contact and they'll turn up and, you know, lights will flash and stuff. And because of the, can you hear that dog barking?
No, it's
okay, we're good, cool. The microphone's doing its job. It's meant to isolate things like that. I've got a very yappy dog next door. I love it, but
hear it now.
It's very small and it's very loud.
Okay.
Let me get back on track. So so this guy in this documentary, Dr. Greer, is giving this idea of CE5. And because of the request I'd been making like 3 weeks prior about wanting evidence for these things like non-local consciousness or universal consciousness, suddenly having this guy say that this is possible, because of the way it happened, I think that's what allowed me to have successful contact, because there was no doubt in my mind. There was no doubt. I'm still, and I've given it a lot of thought afterwards, and I'm still not sure what it was I saw, whether or not it was a psychic projection from my own mind. I'm not 100%. Something happened, like undeniably, multiple times. And I'm not sold on the whole alien narrative 100% in regards to these contact situations, right? But what it showed me, what it demonstrated to me when I had these events, was that life itself, at least in my opinion, seems to have threaded within it some form of conscious medium that responds to you, that can be in some way influenced by you. And that's what happened with me with these sightings of orange orbs. You know, I don't know if you know about my experiences. Have you heard about them before?
I think you've heard them on your channel, yeah, about the orbs. And this is one of the things that, you know, attracted me to your channel was talking about C5 as well. C5 is something that I did, and was actually probably in a way the genesis to this podcast, because I kind of got to know a few people within the C5 community. And whether it's known, I'm officially the CE5 UK podcast, but in some respects that is where I got a lot of
I'm in good company then. I'm in good company. That's good. Yeah. That's good to know. It's good to know, because it's a difficult thing to talk about. And you know, I genuinely try and come at this subject in an intelligent way, because there's so much. Do you mind if I curse lightly sometimes?
Yeah, of course.
There's so much bullshit, in this subject, and I think that's what, you know, turns a lot of people off. And some of it's to do with intelligence community interference over the years, and, you know, narratives have been developed and propagated and built upon. And, you know, even for someone who's really interested, who's an experiencer, my God, I can really get put off the subject sometimes by just the radical nature of some of the like hardcore believers who, you know, kind of have very bold statements about the overarching issue without any evidence. And I don't like that kind of stuff. I've always found that a bit frustrating. And you know, I understand my own position. I don't have evidence for what I saw. I didn't even think about recording any of them. I tried later, but it never worked. And the times where I saw the orbs, I had no intention of filming, like none. I think when people haven't had an experience like that, it can be difficult to understand what kind of psychology is at play when you're experiencing that kind of thing. For me, it was just like a rabbit in headlights. Like I was just completely stunned, and all I could do was lock my eyes and keep looking for as long as humanly possible. Just keep absorbing what the hell it is I'm looking at. And there was no thought to even do anything else. So I don't know if that's, you know, some people might say, oh, you know, it's a psychic phenomena, they lock you in. I think it's just a response to seeing something completely beyond your sense of normality. Yeah, completely.
I totally relate. And from my own experience, I feel that there is there was a turning point in my own consciousness, a kind of a point where I started to doubt my own belief systems to the point I was able to shed them and allow for new belief systems to come in. And it was only at that point did I become to grow beyond that and be able, I guess, to have these the experiences that I've had as well only came through when I was consciously ready. And I think this points to why there are events happening and two people can be standing next to each other and one of them says, I saw a UFO, and the other one just completely goes a bit over their head in a way. And
yeah,
I think it's not that the universe is happening and we're all experiencing it. We are the creators of the universe in a way. We are creating how we understand it. And it's our own, where our consciousness is at is how we experience the phenomenon. It's reflective.
I agree. I think people kind of get caught up in that and say like, oh, well, you know, I experience a tree in front of me and you experience it, so we're all participating in the same thing. But I think when it comes specifically to this anomalous phenomena that seems to exist on the fringes of reality, it's not as easily observed. And it does require a certain, I don't know, intuitive sense, a certain shift in the brain chemistry, a certain shift in your ability to observe on the electromagnetic spectrum. I don't know what it is, but there's something
I don't know if it is that there was a physical aspect to it, but for me there was a kind of like you have to allow for your belief systems to be taken away, and that is quite a difficult thing for a lot of people. It's quite a fearful thing, and you can sort of almost have empathy and a sense of understanding for why some people are so reluctant to get involved in the subject, because from my own experience, I can see why getting involved may bring up some underlying, maybe subconscious fears around losing their belief systems, because it does shake them when you start to see things differently.
I think there are a lot of parallels that can be drawn between a UFO phenomenon and a psychedelic experience. You know, these are two very, very similar and disruptive and neural plasticity accelerating experiences, in terms of they profoundly challenge your status quo. They profoundly challenge your sense of normality. And, you know, it's kind of like, you either build or break. That's kind of what happens, right? You either have a meltdown over the situation, or you actually adapt and you go, oh, okay, things were bigger than I thought they were. Things were brighter than I thought they were. And now I need to adapt and adjust to this new normality. And I think, you know, we see that. And I think right now, and I know that you probably resonate with this as well, we're in a time, even outside of just the UFO community, where ideology and groupthink and ideological kind of rhetoric is preferred to objective fact and information and discussion. And I think that does play a role in the wider trying to understand the bigger implications of our reality. There is such a narrow-minded sense of consciousness that's projected onto us. It's up to us to resist that narrow-minded sense of consciousness. You know, we're all capable of an expanded sense, but the systems in play are continuously projecting in various forms a kind of form of consciousness suppression in different ways, right? Through politics, through social media, through entertainment, through all of the, you know, 24-hour news cycle. This is all stuff that plays that role of refining our consciousness down into something where you can get these ideological cults and groups. And I think that impacts how people perceive reality, and surely will impact how they perceive so-called anomalous phenomena, you know.
Yeah. I think it ties into this, the subject of whether you are someone who regularly watches the news, reads the media, and takes it as the source of information that leads you to make decisions, or do you see it as propaganda coming out from a certain agency? I think there's a shift there as well in terms of your understanding of the information ecosystem that's been part of your life for so long. And I think that was something that happened to me actually when COVID happened, because I was at the time when it happened, I was getting a lot of information, sometimes through podcasts, sometimes through Twitter, YouTube, and various things that showed a completely different narrative to what the news was telling me. And it was difficult to find the truth. And I just decided that the news itself was projecting a fear-based message that I did not want in my life. And I decided to turn it off. And I've hardly watched the news ever since. But a lot of people still watch it. And then, you know, it's, I wonder, that's what plays a role as well. How you use the information ecosystem and what it does to you in terms of your belief systems. Do you trust it? Or do you just see it as someone's agenda? You know?
I mean, I've always been inherently anti-authoritarian ever since school. I've always been like that. You know, I was a smart kid, but I was a bit of a troublemaker, and I'd always get sent out. And I always had a dislike of very disrespectful teachers who just expected us to listen, even if they were being, you know, if I felt that they were wrong or they were behaving badly. So even as a child, and I was just a cocky little kid, I'd probably get annoyed with me as well if I was a teacher. But I have maintained that level of distrust and dislike of authority. And I think when it comes to something like COVID, right? You know, when it first came out, I was like, oh my God, man, this doesn't look good. You know, this doesn't look good. What is happening in China? Oh man, it's come over here. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I'll start washing my hands and I'll start, you know, doing things to mitigate the ability to catch this thing, right? And it was when they rolled out these things. I don't even want to say it, because I do worry about your channel. It was the, like you said, it was the level of demand for compliancy, absolute demand, and gaslighting, like serious gaslighting. You are responsible for your mother, your father, your grandparents. Do not be such a damaging person to society. How dare you even consider that you should challenge this? How dare you? How dare you think that you've got any right to challenge what we're telling you right now? And my problem inherently, mate, is when I hear that, I'm like, not me. Yeah,
for me, I mean, I wouldn't say I was an unruly kid at school, but I've always felt a sense of not wanting to be bossed around and be told what to do. I've kind of wanted to make my own decisions. When with the whole COVID thing, I found it was scary how quickly a society that I felt was free, democratic, and full of the progressive attitudes that I felt were needed in a society that I wanted to live in, very quickly turned to something not too far away from authoritarianism. Looking back, it's scary to think how quickly that can happen. And I'm glad I don't feel like I'm in that world right now. But it was an eye opener. But we're hopefully not going to see that again. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, mate. I think you know, it's a demonstration of just how fear, when appropriately engineered, can have incredible effects on the malleability of human decision making. And I think it also runs in collaboration with not wanting to be the outlier from a group, not wanting to be the one that people point at and go, hey, why are you saying things different to us? So you've got two things happening, right? You've got this incredible sense of fear, which hit me initially, right? I was like, oh my God, man, okay, time to kind of like, you know, let's think about this. Mm. It, you know, this sense of fear, which hit people to the point where they've not recovered. They've not recovered. They're still locked up in their homes with masks taped all over their heads and stuff. You know, they don't, you know, and so the fear, but it's coupled with this incredible mobilization globally of the media and the pharmaceutical and the medical health organizations. Yeah. So you have this like absolute wave of propaganda just coming out over and over. So it's fear laden. And it's also basically getting everyone to behave as a singular group. And that's such a potent thing. I mean, seriously. And I, you know, it was Goebbels, the propagandist for Nazi Germany.
Yeah, I was going to say, I find sometimes if you start talking about the Nazis, you wonder if some people might turn off. But I think,
well, they can turn off if they want, but they shouldn't turn their brains off, because it was Goebbels who said that if you repeat a lie often enough, eventually it becomes the truth. And you know, this is the propagandists at work, and that's what's happened here. And you know, it's a real thing. I think it came from an artificial means. You know, I'm not one of those people that says it's a made up pandemic, but I think it was either leaked or released from the lab, and I don't trust the way that they've handled it. And I think before we move on to anything else, I just think it's been a fantastic exercise though in watching how quickly so-called democratically functioning and running governments will turn to what they actually want in the blink of an eye, which is more authoritarianism, more compliance, more restriction, more regulation of your life. Mm. That's what they ultimately would like, and they didn't get it fully with this. So I share your optimism. Hopefully it doesn't come around.
Having come out of it and sort of looking back, do you still have the beliefs that they in these governments were thinking, oh, here's an opportunity to bring in our authoritarian control?
No, not governments.
Fear, not, and doing, not, or was it a mixture?
It's not governments, mate. It's not governments.
It's
World Economic Forum. It's Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's Klaus Schwab. It's Xi Jinping and the CCP. Yeah. It's, you know, Trudeau, and it's the young global leaders. It's the groups that monitor and regulate the groups that run the governments. And that is a shadow government, but it's not in the shadows. That's the thing that people need to let go of, the shadow government BS. It's not real. The shadow government is in the light, and it's called the World Economic Forum. And these people run the world, not government. It's corporate now. Most people know it's corporate. Data runs everything. Data is the main commodity. If anything, you know, the Microsofts and the Googles probably have a lot more power in terms of leverage than governments these days. They just don't have the military force. They don't have the kinetic power, but they have the data. You know, they have everyone by the digital balls in a sense. So I don't think it's governments necessarily that are going ha ha ha, and I don't even think the people in the World Economic Forum are going ha ha ha. What it is, you know, most people, I would say almost all people who do horrendously evil acts en masse, they don't think they're doing something evil. Doing something evil, but they don't.
That's so a weird,
you know, thing when
about it,
when you've enabled a bunch of billionaire sociopaths who are obsessed with themselves and who think that they are the best because they've accumulated the most resources, they have the right to dictate how you live. They truly believe that. They think it's altruistic. They think they're looking in the long term as, right, well, we'll carve out this utopian superstructure of a society. Most of you will have to die, but that's fine because this thing in the future is going to be brilliant and bright for the rest of us. That they think it's a justifiable sacrifice. And that's what people aren't recognizing yet. When you see them shutting down the farms in Holland, and you see them shutting down, buying up agriculture all over the world, they're literally seizing the assets that we use every day to further control us. And people think that's conspiratorial, and I find that hilarious, because all of this is available on their website, and it's just it's evidential through their actions. You know, all of the people involved in the umbrella of the World Economic Forum are doing all of their pieces to kind of like further coagulate and coalesce power on a global scale. So like, yeah, I don't think it's government so much you have to worry about in that sense. It's more likely to be the maniacal billionaires who nobody voted for, who just think they can do whatever the hell they want to do.
Yeah,
You got me going on a rant now. Yeah, I'm on a rant now.
No, but it is. I mean, you've explained very well where the source of a lot of the issues that we see going on. But I do question to myself, trying to understand reality, because when we try and look at other people, we put ourselves in their shoes and we try and see ourselves doing it. But in this case, I can't see myself acting the way they do. So I'm trying to understand how the world works and try and become a predictor of where things are going.
Well,
I'm trying to understand, are they living through fear, or are they living through power or greed? What are the emotions that's driving the force behind doing things which to us seem anti-human in a way?
I mean, I couldn't tell you, but yeah. I would almost argue emptiness. I think that the people who are expressing the most power and kind of flexing the most on the world stage in terms of the kind of like the globalist billionaires and people like that, that nothing's enough. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Simple life with, my God, you know, even six figures in the account, I'd be happy. I'd be very happy. Mm-hmm. A simple life. They can't have it. They don't function that way, evidently, because they can't hold on to that type of reality. They're always going for more, to the point where now they're, you know, firing rockets into space. Nothing's enough. Nothing's enough. More, more, more. And hey, look, a lot of that drives innovation, right? People who are just driven by, I have to keep going. I have to keep going. And a lot of that has driven innovation. But I think that when you've given a lot of power to a bunch of power hungry billionaire, you know, kind of, psychos who do have an agenda, who have like a vision for how they want to see the world, and it involves you know, a very, very controlled, regulated global trade and economic system that's digital. That's, you know, now they're pushing for the centralization of digital currency, and you know, the steps are being put in place to essentially set up something that is in some ways comparable to a Chinese social credit score, although I don't think we have lived in an authoritarian enough of a regime for them to implicate a social credit score in the same way as China without a lot of people suddenly going, no, it's time for a revolution. I would like to think so, at least, that if it got to that point, then that they would do that. But again, and this is an unpopular one, and people might go, whoa, what's he saying here? And it's not that I have any sort of solid opinion on this, right? But the whole kind of climate change agenda, the problem with that is that it has the ability for people to jump onto it and use climate change as a means to exercise more control over you, you know, your carbon footprint. The billionaires that fly their private jets, right, all the time to places like Davos to decide how you live your life are going to make you suffer for your carbon footprint. Now, you can't tell me that's about climate change. It's not about climate change. It's about restricting your ability to do things, but they're doing it under the guise of something like, oh, you've got to help save the planet. You want to go green, right? But they're the hypocrites. They're the they're the worst ones out of everyone, right? And they're the ones that put the systems in place to actually create such a big carbon footprint. So it's not fair to levy all of the blame onto us when it's them that are the problem. So that's always where I have an issue with their using narratives. It's not that we shouldn't care about the climate. We should protect the rainforest. We should protect the ozone. My God, you know, but this is where people get all split up with it. They might hear me say, oh, you know, there's agendas attached to climate change. You go, oh, Jay doesn't want, and it's like, no, no, no. Of course we want to protect the world. Of course we want to do that. But listen to what they really want to do. Listen to what they're doing beyond just the message of sustainability or going green or build back better and all of this stuff. Look beyond the message. Look deeper into what they're actually trying to do. And you'll see that it's a Trojan horse. It's dressed up as something like climate change or, you know, some form of altruistic thing for the world. And it's not. It never has been. You know, it never has been, has it? You know, the billionaire globalist class. Yeah, they're always doing just fantastic things for the world. That's why world hunger is solved. We don't have world hunger anymore, or human trafficking, right? Oh, wait, they're all happening and they're being created by those people. So, at some point, I hope we get to grips with that properly. And I don't really know what can be done about it, because they are the most powerful, let's be honest. So what do you do about that? I'm not quite sure.
Well, we have podcasts where we talk about it.
Raise awareness. I think that's all you can do as a simple average Joe is raise awareness, right?
But also try and give our thoughts in a way that can be reasoned with. And the reason I say that is because I do find it difficult talking about the climate change agenda because it is very fused and a lot of people feel like you're now against looking after the planet. That's not the case at all. I really want to look after the planet. I just see the potential for us as a global system, amongst many other things, to potentially put all our time, resources, energy into stopping the to control how much CO2 is in the atmosphere and completely miss out on all the other things that we are doing to the world, where we should be putting our resources in terms of looking after the oceans and the forests and the habitats and things that do matter. And I agree with. And now I know that when people say, oh, climate change, they do often, that's sort of an umbrella term for looking after the planet. But actually, to me, no, climate change is making sure that everyone is controlled in terms of how much CO2 they emit, which itself can be debated. I think there are scientists on both sides of the aisle. It's not settled that CO2 is causing global warming, but, you know, and that's the hard thing. I'm not convinced by the science on that. And if someone wants to convince me, great, and may think I'm an idiot, I haven't looked at the right articles or whatever, but
yeah, but it's the same.
There's an agenda. Definitely.
It's the same with COVID, mate. Like, I don't understand the science on climate change or on COVID. I'm not a scientist. I don't understand the science on electrogravitics, the things that I discuss when it comes to UFOs. You don't need to understand the science to observe the behavior and analyze the outcome and kind of look at what they're actually trying to do. That's what really happened to me with the pandemic is, you know, I'm not going to pretend to understand, you know, all the different kind of caveats of epidemiology and all that. That's ridiculous. All I'm looking at is, oh, why are all these doctors getting banned? Why are all these censorships happening? What, you know, so it's, you don't have to be a scientist to look at, for example, climate change and just look at the people involved and go, oh, hang on, aren't they kind of mainly they're responsible for the climate change. If there is, you know, some significant shift, it's their fault. And they're telling us we have to change our lifestyle for a better outcome. Oh, okay, now I understand what they're saying. It's not about climate change. Right, so there we go. So, you know, yeah, it's just deciphering the real meaning underneath this lovely little, you know, kind of charade and this bit of velvet they put over it, you know. That's all it really comes down to.
Yeah. Fascinating discussion and all topics that's very, very dear to me, but I would like to talk about UFOs.
If you haven't been banned yet, I'm sure this conversation will probably get you banned.
Well, I'll start the interview now. Hi, Jay. No, so basically, I wanted to talk about some of your interviews, and most notably, the one with Bobby Ray Inman. I found that one of the most uncomfortable interviews that I've ever watched, not because of the way you presented it, but just the body language, the chemistry, everything about it just seemed, there was an oddness to it that I wonder if you could shed light on what your feelings were during that and everything afterwards.
Yeah, that was a weird one, wasn't it? It was a weird one. I didn't expect to get it either. You know, I was really surprised when I got that. So this is another thing, right? And I'll answer what your question, but this is another thing. People sometimes think that, you know, for example, I'm in the Ministry of Defense or I'm some sort of IC guy because I've managed to get quite a few people from different intel or military ranks on for interviews. It's really, I mean, there have been some special cases where I've known someone who's known someone and they've reached out privately and they've agreed and whatever. But for example, Admiral Inman, and a lot of people were like, how did he get Admiral Inman? Yeah. Nobody's got him. How? Dude, his email address is online and his phone number. He teaches at a university. I found his EDU page. You know, it's not that hard, really not that hard. And so we called him up and we had no answer, left a voicemail. A week later, my colleague gets a phone call back from him. And it was this that made me think that it was this that made me think that the universe had aligned and that this guy was going to spill the beans, because he said, oh, hey, you know, this is him and blah, blah, blah. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said, this is a phone that I haven't used in over a year. I keep it locked in my cupboard. I keep it locked in my desk drawer. I just checked it on a whim and found your voicemail. And I was just like, you know, it felt like destiny had intervened. So I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this is going to happen. Is he really going to, am I going to get him to literally confess this on the record? So I was really, you know, nervous about the interview. And he's the only person, honestly, scout's honor, he's the only person who's ever needed questions beforehand. You know, I've interviewed Lou and other people, you know, in the IC. Nobody's ever needed a pre-approved set of questions or topics. He wanted topic, not questions, topics. Like, you know, what are the themes that we're going to be discussing? And that's another thing. People think I tricked him. I didn't trick him. I might not have been completely as open about my interest. Like, oh, I didn't show him that I was, you know, like kind of low-key obsessed about UFOs. But I had put a whole list of themes, national security and geopolitics, the impact of China and, you know, Eastern power dynamics as we unfold. Like things I knew he'd be attached and, you know, attracted to giving his opinion on, you know, like, oh, I'll tell you how I feel about China and about Russia and about this. So I knew he'd be interested in that. And I also put in the themes, I think I'd worded it like the 2017 onwards UFO process and conversation in government and / Congress or whatever. So he knew I wanted to talk about UFOs. He might not have known specifically how deep I wanted to go, but he wasn't tricked. He knew that it was going to come up, right?
And he could have spent some time to research you and find out a bit more if he was, you know, worried or concerned. So he did have an opportunity.
It says on his Wikipedia page, the spy master. If he had just done a couple of minutes of due diligence, I'm pretty sure he would have run like the coyote away from my YouTube channel, because he would have become very clear that I had a singular interest in this conversation. So the rest of it was just, you know, all due respect, if you're listening, Admiral, I do apologize. But, you know, the 90% of the interviews, it's not about that. It's that 10% where I got on the UFO stuff. Like that's what I was, that's the whole thing was about that. And I knew I had to do, like, you know, maybe like half an hour of other things first. It's tactics, you know, it's getting someone to relax a little bit, getting someone to trust you or be on that level of like, oh, he's, you know, we can match each other and talk about these things. So I was, you know, talking about the, like I said, the geopolitical issues and wider global issues, and he was relaxed. He was sitting back, you know, he was reminiscing, he was talking about this, he was, you know, he was there, la, 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 you know, he was enjoying himself. He was having a good time kind of telling me how he feels about these different things. And this is what people picked up on. And I emailed there's a couple of them out there, but there's a really popular one where these body language specialists have a YouTube channel. They break down very famous videos or very important videos. I sent them it. I'm going to have to send them again because I don't know if they saw the email. I'm really hoping they pick up on it because I feel like it's worthy of it. I feel like it's worthy, you know, it's such a high ranking guy with such an incredible implication of his level of involvement in this subject and, like, you know, what his body language is telling us. But even without being a body language specialist, I mean, the transition from relaxed to this was just, you know, the moment UFOs came up. And that, I, you know, a lot of body language specialists will say this is kind of a subconscious, I'm not going to tell you anything, I'm keeping it in, I'm keeping it, you know, locked into myself. It's a subconscious thing we do when we're holding things back. We start actually mimicking the thought that we're having, that we're mimicking the idea of holding back. So yeah, like when we got onto Bob Exler and reverse engineering and the implications of what he said to him, which he totally said to him 100%. And, you know, there are other people who have good connections in the IC who have said multiple times to me that Admiral Inman really, right, you know, just cherry on top. He's right there. He's one of the guys. He's one of the main guys. And I don't doubt that for a second. Why he came on, I don't know. I don't think he'll come back.
But it was interesting to watch the body language. Okay, we didn't get any information, but we think we saw enough from the body language of he's not saying he doesn't believe in UFOs because he doesn't believe in UFOs. He's hiding something. There was definitely
well, that's the thing is
going on in his head.
I know it's not for like a court of law, but for me, and I don't know, maybe people will critique me on this. It's just my own personal thing, but for me, that is information. Like his behavior is information. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's not going to full on say, yeah, Jay, I was there and I'm part of MJ-12. Like, you know, he's not going to say that, but his body language, his refusal to, you know, his immediate, yeah. when I brought up Bob Exler, he acknowledged knowing him, but when I said about reverse engineering, no UFOs, there were no UFOs, absolutely nothing like that. I have high confidence in that. It's like, dude, like, you know, like all of that to me is information. It's not what we want, but yeah, I personally, I would say, yeah, there we go, got you. You know, and we know.
You know something.
You're not telling the truth. You're not telling the truth, my brother.
Yeah, yeah. Another
wild interview. Can't believe I got that.
And another interview, which was quite notable, was the one with Oak Shannon.
Mm,
and also, in particular, some of the fallout that happened around that. And someone I'm thinking about is Grant Cameron.
Oh, man, that's all dead and buried now. No one gives a shit about that.
Oh, well, the question I wanted to ask was hope things were okay and all squared up. And it was dead and buried, I guess.
Oh, well, with GC, I've got nothing but love for him, man. I've got nothing but love for Grant. He's a good guy. He's a great researcher. Like, the whole thing was just a miscommunication, bit of drama, nipped in the bud, whatever. It's all good. You know, it's all good. At the end of the day, we're all in this for the same reason, right? We want to try and get stuff out. Yeah.
And following on from that, is there any update on the ongoing saga of the Admiral Wilson notes and anything new on that sphere that you can be shared, or is it all pretty?
I think not to toot my own horn, but I think the latest is Oak Shannon. You know, the latest development of the Wilson documents would be that, you know, he came out on the record, and I still think that is a you know, that alone is a very unique little data point to now have, because it becomes very difficult to say that this could be falsified when a name involved in the documents literally says, yeah, all the things said about me in those documents are true. Like, they're all true. So how do you get facts about someone's personal things, his health, his literal health at the time? He'd had like a major heart attack, died on the operating table, couldn't talk at the time. Admiral Wilson said that, you know, it'd be really great if Oak could be with us, but he's got really bad heart issues. Linda told me on the phone, Linda, who is his wife. So like, how do you get, how do you fake that? Like, how do you sit down and write something and it's like me knowing your name, mate, and then just making up a couple of things, and they're like totally true, and they're like personal things about your health and who you had a phone conversation with at some time. It's like, come on, you're having a laugh. You're joking, right? It's obviously real. Yeah. So, you know, the meeting, in my opinion, the meeting 100% happened. The documents 100% real. Eric Davis 100% wrote them. Whether or not what was said to Admiral Wilson is true is a completely different kettle of fish. That's a completely different conversation. The things that these apparent gatekeepers said to him, do they have that retrieved craft? Is it alien? Is it something else? We don't know. And I don't know if he was told the truth. He was also told that there's no abductions, that they're not real. I don't know, because I really don't have like a kind of a vested opinion on what really goes on with the abductions. It's I just don't really have a strong enough opinion on what they really are. And so, yeah, I think that's really, if you honestly look at all of the different data points, and there are a lot of them, and you string them all together, you have a lot more on this side, legitimacy, than you do on this side, made up, script, story, fake, you know, whatever. There's just so much more on this side. And, you know, he, like, these Ugh, it's just annoying. These people have all said it's real. Like, you know, the ones who are on the, not Admiral Wilson, but everyone else, all the other, like, you know, Eric, Hal, Lou, Gary, they're all on the same group, man. Like, they've all said it's real because they know it's real, and they just can't say it because there's a literal national security implication involved with the classified information being trafficked to someone who shouldn't have received it, which is Eric Davis, who was the recipient of illegitimately trafficked classified information, which he should never have been given by Admiral Wilson. So, like, they can't ever say that until there's some sort of legislative process put into place, which we're now seeing with the whistleblowers and the NDAA. So, you know, who knows if that's actually been a mechanism that in some ways was set up with the intention of bringing that to the forefront. And you've got to remember that Gary Nolan spoke to, and I've completely blanked on the senator's name or the congressman's name now, which is annoying because I usually have it right there in my head, but it's gone. He briefed on the Admiral Wilson documents before he went to question the two Pentagon officials. If you can remember his name, tell me. But
I'm going to go through names. Obviously, there's Tim Burchett's on in there.
And, not Burchett.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Warner. Who questioned the two Pentagon? You know what I'm talking about with Kirkpatrick and Moultrie when they're sitting in the Pentagon.
Yeah. Question about the Wilson notes.
Yeah. He messed it up. I think he said Admiral Davis and Dr. Wilson or something like that. Yeah, I was like,
they kind of blanked on it. Oh, I've never heard of that. Yeah.
I was like, you had one job, bro. You had one job and you messed it up. Thing is, you got to think of it this way as well, right? You got to think of it this way. The people he's questioning, they're Pentagon linguistic bureaucrats. He said the wrong name. So, of course, they're congressionally, you know, they're allowed to say, I've never heard of that. I've never heard of that. If he'd used the right bloody names, then they would literally have been lying in Congress. But because he used the wrong names, they weren't lying in Congress, technically. You know, and a lawyer could certainly prove that would be, you know, that's thrown out, you know, closed case.
It hasn't occurred to me, actually, that thought that it may have been deliberate.
I hope not. I really hope not. That would suck. I want to think it was a mistake, and I want to think they didn't really know. But there is a part of my brain that goes, it's either like, you know, he made a mistake and they went, made a mistake.
The conspiracy side of me just jumped out there. I'll put him back.
yeah, exactly. Right. So, yeah, I mean, what I'm saying with the Wilson documents is I think they may be used as a mechanism through Congress. I think a lot of, I know quite a few congressional people have seen the documents or aware of the documents. You know, they've been inserted into the congressional record. Now you can literally go onto uscongress.gov and download documents about a DIA Flagstaff director talking about reverse engineering. That's pretty nuts to me. That's kind of wild. Yeah. I think the Wilson documents and Oakshannon coming out on the record, I think, is the latest development with that stuff. And I wouldn't be surprised if they kept surfacing over the next year or two as things just kind of bubble around in Congress and, you know, we start seeing the hearings. We'll just have to see. But I have a feeling that the Wilson documents are actually in some way an integral component of this structure that's being developed in government to handle this topic. It's right. Almost like it's the smoking gun for reverse engineering.
Well, talking about Congress and the developments, the hearings, you talked about Moultrie and was it Kirkpatrick as well?
I think so. I might be messing that up because Kirkpatrick's the guy that I think was head of UAPTF. The thing is, there's so many names and so many acronyms. I can barely keep up.
Yeah, and there was that AIMSOG ridiculousness. But do you think, especially with the recent developments coming from Senator Gillibrand, who said that she came up and said, look, these are underfunded, and we've heard about how little staff there is in this new office. Do you sometimes see that this could all be Project Blue Book happening again?
Well, I mean, it's all a money-making opportunity. You got to remember that as well. Like, you know, like as much as we want to hold people like Gillibrand and Rubio and even Bouchet and others on some pedestal, like they're doing it for their own political clout as much as, you know, they might be curious, which is totally fine. And I'm sure they are curious. You know, you'd have to be a bit weird to not actually be curious when you're getting to sit down with the pilots and you're getting to sit in those situations, right? So I'm sure they are actually curious, but you know, there's going to be their own personal agenda. They're politicians, right? So they're going to look for ways to gain more funding for their own campaigns and ways to gain more of a voting demographic and all of that kind of stuff that just comes with the territory. But I don't know about Blue Book. Look, man, I don't trust the government. I don't trust... Right. This is another thing that I have an issue with the UFO community in general, and I, you know, I don't want anyone to feel like I'm painting them with this brush, but there are certainly people out there that seem to feel this way, which is that, you know, the UFO secrecy issue is the only issue where the government can't really be trusted, and you know, they kind of toe the line on everything else. It's like, guys, we are dealing with an inherently corrupt system. Like, not just, you know, it's not the Democrats, the Republicans, like the system itself, the basic foundations upon which this whole thing relies upon its survival is corruption and blackmail and all this like kind of like favors and DC back scratching and all that kind of stuff. It's all slimy and backdoor politics, and it's not cool, and it's not good, it's not democratic, it's not free. And I just think that people need to recognize that when looking at something like the UFO subject, when looking at COVID, when looking at, you know, anything out there that's being propagated as a major talking point, we need to challenge, even if you agree with it. So, like, we all want disclosure, right? We want, you know, we want major admissions from government. But you have to genuinely think about this. You know, is the US government and that's a very blanket statement, because we all know, and I think most people listening who are a part of this research community know, it's not government moving as one, and most people in government haven't got a clue what's going on with this subject. Mm-hmm. But there's a very powerful little niche in different agencies and different aspects that kind of have a lot of influence on the way that this giant structure moves, and they can kind of stop things from coming out in the way that we want it to come out, right? That's kind of their deal. So the secrecy state, the national secrecy state. So even if you enjoy and want to see, you know, disclosure with a capital D, it's always going to be coming out in a way that's going to serve an agenda for, you know, the military industrial complex, the intelligence community. And that's not a good thing. That's not going to be a transparent disclosure. They're not going to just be like, okay, look, here are the answers that we've had for the last 70 years. You know, this is what we've understood. It's going to have a national security, you know, imperative stamped onto it. It's going to have some sort of, you know, domestic and foreign policy agenda stamped onto it. It's going to be managed and controlled in a way that kind of allows them to maintain hegemony and allows them to maintain influence, and especially allows them to maintain inordinate amounts of funding for the military industrial complex, right? So, like, I can never be like fully supportive of it, because I don't think it's going to grease the right wheels. I think it's just going to, you know, if we have a highly funded UFO program in the government, okay, like, what's that going to do? I'd rather have a highly funded private research group do it. I'd rather have an NGO do it than you guys in the national security state who have stolen people's inventions for the last 70 years and profited off of it from the Department of Energy and, you know, the Invention Secrecy Act and all of this stuff. Like, I don't want you in control of it. Why would we want the people who wage wars and lie to their people? And I'm not talking about Americans, I'm talking about literally like the Western world. And I only say the Western because I'm a part of it. People get very weird these days. I'm not saying I'm pro-East, pro-Russia, pro-China, but I live in the West, so I can comment on the West.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Western world is run by very dangerous, powerful people. So, you know, you just need to be very cautious about all of this stuff. Even if you want to see disclosure, you have to be questioning the government narrative on it. You really have to, you know. And you asked me something a while ago about listening to mainstream media. Like, I'll listen to mainstream media. don't trust it. I'll kind of analyze it, and you hear the talking points. You know, if you really just train yourself, you pick up on all these little talking points where they're trying to steer you into a certain direction. Because that's the thing with the news. It's not that everything is a lie. It's not like the whole thing is a lie. They'll show you a reality, and then they'll embed little kind of like nudges towards a certain narrative of that.
I find the news is not just about how they manufacture, how they present the news, but it's how they filter out what isn't news is even bigger.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's the idea of, you know, you've got a story. Here's 100% of the story, right? We're going to take 50% of that. Then we're going to carve that down into 30% of our narrative. And then you get to look at it. So it's like you're getting, you know, a fractured glass perspective of reality through the news so that you can pick up threads of truth. But it's got an agenda. It's got a narrative, whether it's serving left or right or the military or the corporate, whatever. You know, you can pick up on it quite easily. It's very easy to do in America because literally every single show like ends with like sponsored by Pfizer, sponsored by Pfizer. Like, you know, they don't even hide it. They don't even hide who the hell's running their information. Wild. That's one thing I struggled with actually going out to the States, bro. Like, is just the level of like there are so many pharmaceutical adverts on the TV. Like, you know, when you're watching TV or something, all of the adverts, I think like 6 out of 8 commercials in the commercial breaks were like the really intense medical things, like really intense medicines that had like a long list of side effects. And they have like a happy family celebrating in the sunshine as they just like list all the ways that this thing might wreck you. And I was just like, wow. And they have this just projected all the time, 24/7. It's very interesting. Like in America specifically, as you know, as a British guy who doesn't see that, and we don't see that in this country, it's very weird. Only in America and New Zealand, they're the only two countries, you know, that America and New Zealand are the only two countries that allow the commercials to run on pharmaceuticals. And it's pretty weird when you get exposed to it. It's very different. It's very weird.
I am planning to go to the States this year, so I'll
where are you thinking of going? Where are you thinking of going?
Sort of Santa Monica area around there.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's a family meetup. So looking forward to it. But at the same time, I'm going to wonder how I'm going to integrate in a society that has a very polarized atmosphere and views that sometimes I might.
How long are you out there for?
It's only a couple of weeks, and
I'm sure you'll be all right.
So yeah, I won't integrate or anything, but it'll be odd, you know. Maybe we'll see.
Americans are incredibly friendly and talkative people, is what I've noticed on my experiences in meeting people in America in different states. Is that, you know, they're very warm and they're very welcoming and they're very chatty, very talkative, which, you know, the British sometimes get a bit put off by because we're so shy around each other and we're so kind of like, oh, sorry, yes, okay, bye-bye, yes.
Quick
sentence like, oh, how are you doing today? Oh, not too bad. And then you move on. But in America, if I say, how are you doing today? They'll be like, oh, buddy, I've had the craziest day. So basically it started off with, it's like they'll just talk to you. You know, so I love the cultural differences between the US and the UK. It's fun. And so I end up changing things when I'm out there. Like I start saying sidewalk instead of pavement, or I start saying tomato. I honestly start saying tomato because it's just easier to say tomato out there. When you say tomato, they don't understand what you're saying.
Well, keeping with America, and certainly at the moment with things going on in the world, I wonder if I could ask you a bit more on your views on Trump. And I'm sure this is another area that is going to divide audiences.
You're going for like the algorithmic high score of please shadow ban me.
But actually, no, I'm going to ask you, first question is actually more around John Trump, who Donald Trump's uncle, worked at MIT. Is this something that shows that Donald Trump has access to information that he's not sharing? Or do you think it's all a bit of a conspiracy theory, let's say?
You'd be good pressed to ask my friend that, Jean-Luc. Have you ever seen the chats I've done? They're called the Dream Team chats with Jean-Luc and John Majerowski. Ever seen those?
Don't believe I have actually. I'm not
no
sure.
Worries. Well,
To be fair,
there's only a couple of them on my YouTube channel, and then the majority of them went onto my friend John's channel. But
Jean-Luc rings a bell as a name, but I can't remember off the top of my head. So
have you heard of the channel UFOs on the Level?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. Well, that's his channel. Anyway, long story short, our friend Jean-Luc would be a perfect person to ask that question to. And the only reason I say that is because there was a thread he'd done on Twitter, which I wish my memory was photographic enough to quote from, because it was interesting. And it involves the, have you ever heard of, is it called the Sonoya or the Sonoya Aero Club? The Soroya Aero Club? God, I'm messing this up, man. Mm-hmm. I wish I was more prepared for this particular question, because there is something. Hang on. Sorora? I bet there's a few people yelling at their screens right now saying what it is. I'll try and find it later. But anyway, basically, yeah, there's this weird aero club that existed back in, like the 1900s or something. It was a very kind of secretive, elite, exclusive aero club of people, and a lot of people believe that they might have been responsible for the whole Zeppelin flap, the whole kind of like weird UFO Zeppelin sightings that were seen back in the day, because this is kind of what these people used to. I'm trying to remember the name of it whilst I'm talking, but don't worry about it. I'll find it later, but it is really interesting, this aero club. And on some of the patents, on some of the illustrations, there was like Trump was written all over it. And his uncle was an inventor, and there was a whole thread of things. I'm really annoyed because I'm not the guest for this question. I know people who would be able to give you really interesting answers to this question, because I don't know enough about it. It was just a cursory thing that I'm aware of, but I will answer in general terms. I would say it's probably not that likely that he knows anything that's like truly disruptive. And the reason I say that is because looking at Trump's personality, like looking at the kind of person he is, kind of feel like he would have used that as bragging rights before then, and maybe even maintained that as a talking point now, which he hasn't done. He was like, as UFOs were popular, if you remember, this was at the height of like UFOs being reported in the news during the Trump administration, and he was asked questions. He's an egotistical guy, so yeah, he's probably going to inflate his own level of knowledge and say, oh, I've been told a few things about Roswell, let me tell you something. Oh, they're definitely hiding something. And hell, he's probably right. But I don't know if... I kind of feel like if he actually had something that he knew, like he knows that there's like a deep state that has anti-gravity or something, man, if he wouldn't have said it, he would have hinted way more than he has, because his ego could not hold that in. His ego could not hold in something that big. I just feel so. I think it was probably just hyperbole. It was probably just overinflation, in all honesty. Okay.
And turning more to recent developments, what do you think is going on with this whole arrest? I see it as a bit as a witch hunt. Do you agree on that? The whole kind of
I mean, like, look, at the end of the day, and people want to call me all sorts of things on Twitter. Not a lot of people, mind you, but a few people would like to really consider me as some sort of alt-right, pro-Putin, Trump supporter, which I'm not. Any of those things. I think that it was very clear that he did not represent the establishment, because the establishment made a concerted effort to just completely, you know, put him under a magnifying glass. And so for me, it's not about political allegiance, because, well, for one, I'm British. So, although America has a big impact on us as a major, you know, one of our oldest and most trusted partners, part of the Five Eyes, certainly an important geopolitical giant to pay attention to, who will influence our own decision making. So it's definitely okay to have opinions on American politics as a British citizen. What I would say is that it's the clear hypocrisy that does my head in. It's just the hypocrisy. Trump's a douchebag. He's a billionaire. you know, selfish, egotistical douchebag, and he's probably done loads of things that are criminal. Cool. So is Hillary Clinton. So is Bush.
I think
so is
that,
Obama.
That's where I find it difficult to accept a lot of the accusations pointed at Trump when, firstly, we were aware of the criminality suggested that's going on behind the scenes with the Bushes, the Clintons, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not like they're all, you know, they've got no skeletons in their closet. But well, it's the fact that people said that Trump, when he came in, all this bad stuff would happen. But the reality was, and this is just from a neutral perspective, there wasn't a war during his time there.
Because he's such a loose cannon. He even said that he would nuke Beijing. You know, who knows if the dude's joking? He said he would nuke Beijing. You don't think Xi Jinping was sitting there going, well, he might. He might. I don't know. This guy's kind of crazy. But with Joe Biden, it's just like roll right through. Roll right through. And, you know, I just think that we need a drastic reshuffle of political leadership in the West, in our country as well, mate. I mean, you know, let's not throw too much you know, cold water on our colonial brothers and sisters when we have Rishi Sunak, the stooge of the Global World Economic Forum, who is running our country, who wants nothing more than to stop everyone from the countries we're destroying from coming here and you know, seeking some sort of assistance, and also wants to prevent any of us from having any sort of meaningful amount of money. And wants to control that through digital currency. So yeah, I mean, like we're all in a bad state. We're all in a bad state. You know, you've got a geriatric president in America. You've got a globalist, money hungry sociopath in England. You've got is Emmanuel Macron still in France, or is he buggered off now?
No, I think he's still there. And
he's still there.
Writing.
Emmanuel Macron, World Economic Forum, Young Global Leadership Program, Justin Trudeau, Young Global Leadership Program, World Economic Forum, Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand, Young Global Leadership Program, World Economic Forum, Boris Johnson, Young Global Leadership Program. Like, you know, do I have to keep repeating the pattern, or can we just say that these people are all part of an agenda it's not about countries, it's about a structure beyond countries. You know, that's the danger. Like, real quick, and I know I'm kind of talking a lot, but I just have so many thoughts on this, is that you have like Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum is in the chairman, CEO, chairman of the World Economic Forum, who literally said, you know, this was like a year ago, and he was like, oh, a year ago I was visiting Trudeau in Canada, and you know, I know that when I go into his cabinet, half or more than half are for our World Economic Forum, you know. And he said it in his, you know, scary Bond villain German accent, where it's just like, ah, oh, yes, I went and the cabinets. He literally said, we have penetrated the cabinets. You know, they've penetrated the cabinets. Penetrated.
Well, going back
government.
To what you said earlier, it's all hidden in plain sight, isn't it?
Hidden in plain sight, man. Hidden in plain sight. You know, why is Joe Biden and Boris Johnson and Justin Trudeau and Emmanuel Macron and Jacinda Ardern all saying build back better, build back better? They all just like decide that was a fun slogan. Like, no, they're all part of the same chanting, the same group, the same cult, the same movement, same agenda. And they want to present themselves as little pockets of influence in different countries, but really they're just nodes. They are nodes on a network that leads towards what? A global autocracy, World Economic Forum. That's what it is. It's the dystopian nightmare that no one wants to see happen, where you have, you know, Global Corp, the thing that runs the whole world, like in some sci-fi Blade Runner-esque kind of scenario, where you have, you know, Globo Corp. That's the World Economic Forum. If that's allowed to succeed, that's what it becomes. It becomes the global corporate government, and everyone's existing on like credits, and you know, it's a bit of a shitty thing to live in. So I don't really want to live in that.
No.
If that does happen, rest assured, I will be a part of some scruffy ragtag rebellion trying to run around solving problems.
Now that I've got more involved with the UFO topic, I now watch Star Wars and see it as a form of, I guess, describing the choice point that we have right now as we look to our future. Do we want to be a world owned by what we would consider, if we look at the movie, as being the Empire in terms of, you know, the highly structured, highly formulated system where we're all part of one machine? Or do we want to be like in Tatooine or whatever, the part of the rebellion that just kind of just live life as peacefully as possible,
but I'm Tatooine
starfighters and shoot off a couple of Empire people.
I'm Tatooine all the way, baby.
Me too, but I think it's if people want to kind of try and understand what this choice point is about that we're kind of entering in, I feel like it's a good way of describing what world would you rather live in, you know? And I think most people would rather live in the Tatooine world, but they don't realize that they're probably supporting the Empire, maybe unintentionally, you know, in a way.
I do have optimism for anyone listening. I am actually genuinely optimistic about the future, because I kind of just think, you know, the moments in my own life where it just like, oh no, nothing's ever going to be good again. I was always wrong. And like, you know, or like worrying about something and creating a situation in my head. The situation's always worse than the actual event that unfolds
like
in real life.
Exam or something. Like,
So like we always exaggerate too much in our own mind. And so like, when you look at global authorities and AI and surveillance and data, it's like, oh my God, nothing's going to be good again. But that's not true. It's like there are going to be tough times. It's just like anyone's life. It's just like an individual life. You don't want to go through life without a single tough time. If that happens, one, it's a miracle. It should never happen. And two, you're going to be a boring person. You're going to be a boring, unwise, underdeveloped person. You need to go through struggle. It's just part of life.
Well, that leads me on to some very pertinent questions about, I guess, the nature of reality and of consciousness, which is a very something that I'm also very interested in. Actually, before I turn on to that, you said right at the beginning about your interest in, I think it was in quantum mechanical structure and consciousness. And I think for me, looking back, before I kind of got into understanding the UFO cover-up and the false narratives and everything, before that, I was really interested in understanding the quantum nature of reality and the people like Michael Talbot, who did a really good book, and the theories. I think it's Gerard de Hooft and Hawking talked about how they saw the universe as a 3D projection on a 2D surface, and they could show through physics and the black holes how that was possible based on the information and understanding Hawking radiation, I think it was. But this went on to me, and someone who did, you know, I did physics and astronomy at university, so I'm very sort of scientific, and I was really interested in cosmology and the Big Bang, which, you know, is all very interesting. And I guess at that time I was starting to think maybe nature is it a simulation, is it a hologram? And since then I've come to the belief in my mind, I see the universe is consciousness is primary, and the material world is secondary, built on that. So what wonder what your thoughts are around that.
Well, you know what's funny is I have so many thoughts on that, so I'm going to try not to go on a tirade, but you know what's funny about that, man, is that we actually have a saying that we just throw out there as if we don't really think about it. And what is that saying? When you need to do something and you're not doing it, mate, what am I going to say to you? I'll say, hey, listen, man, it's mind over matter. Mind over matter, because mind is over matter. And we have literally forgotten how powerful of a statement that is. We just use it. Mind is over matter. It sits above it. It is the dominant part of the hierarchy of the universe. And I truly believe that. And I think that quantum mechanics and simulation theory, you know, it's just a very analytical approach to what is, in my opinion, an esoteric question, but it is an analytical question. You know, what's at the foundation of reality? What's at the foundation of the process? You know, what we understand as reality is so fragmentary. It's so incomplete. But we present this overwhelming sense of hubris as if we've figured it out. We figured out the basics, at least. We figured out this, the kind of like this This template, we're on a level playing field, and now we're just trying to understand the more exotic ideas. But this, in my opinion, this is not true. There are no foundations upon which science is built ultimately, because ultimately there's only one foundation upon which the rest of the architecture is constructed. So whether you're a quantum physicist or a biochemist or anything else, what truly lies at the foundation of all of this is, how did any of this start to begin with? And this is the big glitch. This is the big glitch in the assumption that we have a sturdy foundation upon which this towering edifice of science has been constructed. We don't have a clue how the universe began. No evidence, no data to provide that would solidify it into a conclusion or an explanation. So the truth is that we're studying the effects of the creation of time and space, but we're not studying the cause of time and space. The cause is beyond our ability to perceive. And my suggestion, at least this is how I see it, is that whilst this insight remains kind of obscured by the rudimentary tools of science, when faced with the grandest mystery, what lies at the bedrock of creation, what lies at the foundation of the process, consciousness, and specifically perturbed or altered states of consciousness, seem to offer up data, something that can assist in this process of understanding how all of this started and what it really means. And the desire to refine my own understanding of consciousness has continued to be a source of inspiration for me in the UFO research field as well. But this is the problem. This is the problem for me, is that we don't know we can't describe the beginnings. We don't know how it all started. And so consciousness is this untapped aspect, and it's a very general thing to say that consciousness, you know, because we don't really know what is consciousness, but just the hidden corridors of expanded mind and the weird things that people can experience and see in different types of orientations of consciousness. This, we don't explore this enough. We're starting to, yeah, with psychedelics, you know, the psychedelic studies, and we're starting to kind of go down these novel routes of, like, you know, oh, what happens when we perturb it like this? Oh, okay, well, you know, let's figure out why these deities are saying things to us in these states. But this is, for the most part, a really unexplored avenue of science in the kind of, like, post-Age of Enlightenment. You know, we had a very esoteric science before the Age of Enlightenment. Newtonian reductionism kind of set in as the foundational basics for physics and for applying the scientific method. Before then, you had very esoteric scientists. And before then, you had shamans. And I think what's needed now, and I kind of feel, and this is where I'll shut up in a second, because I told you, I'll just keep talking. I will just keep talking, but I want to just finish this thought off, is that what I think is that we've gone from the shamanistic to the technical, to the techno-shamanistic. I think that's where we might be going, the techno-shamanistic, where you have this meeting in the middle between esoteric and scientific, between intuition and logic, between analytics and whatever you want to call it, the physics and metaphysics, spirit and science. I think that these things are kind of coming to this meeting point. And who knows, maybe AGI and this whole singularity. I mean, my God, man, Mikai Morin blowing my brain the other day on the interview I had with him recently for like 2.5 hours, just telling me about how AI is going to change everything. And, like, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's like some weird post singularity event, or, you know, that we're moving towards. And after that, it's like spirit and science are mixed together. But a little bit like how we can't envision the beginning of time and space, I feel like it's almost impossible to envision what happens in the near future, because I feel like something's coming, man. Like, I can't fully explain it. I felt it since like 2020, like about 2020, I was like, you know what? This decade, man, there's something about it in my gut. Do I need to get a bug out bag? Do I need to buy tins of beans? Do I need to invest in cryptocurrency? Do I need to buy gold? I know I need to be preparing, but I don't know what for. Something's happening. And found out I'm not alone in that. My God, so many people feel the same. And then you have, you know, people like Mikai who come on and say, my literal data, my analytics, my projections, because that dude's just like a savant. He's just analytics, data, data. Yeah. And he's like, my projections say we're coming towards a singularity in less than 10 years. And then it's just like, oh my God, man, Like, you know, was my intuition correct? Are we coming towards something radical that's going to change everything? And maybe after that, we will understand consciousness a bit better. Or it'll be Blade Runner. I don't know, man. Like, it's really hard to tell what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
I gave you a lot there. I'm sorry. I gave you a hell of a lot.
No, it's interesting. I there's two ways of looking at that. One is very positive and one's very negative, I guess. The very positive view is that we're all going to come out of this and we're all going to kind of grow spiritually and I guess technically as well and be able to start to voyage amongst the stars and become one of many different civilizations out there. And the other one is that we just have there's a reset, I guess. But yeah. I don't know if I can prep as well for what's coming for the future. As you say, we don't know.
Don't know what to prep for.
Yeah, I don't know what to prep for. But also, I think if you are a prepper, you're drawing a target on your back when things go south.
You are drawing a target on your back, but you have more things to fire back at other targets with. So, you know, it's yeah. We're a bit screwed in the UK, really, because if the apocalypse happens, I mean, we'll be back to sword fighting, mate. There's no guns. Everyone will just be
yeah. Right well, out. I am trying to grow plants and stuff, but we just don't have the climate. As you say, we're talking about the weather again, but
no,
it's difficult.
No.
We're not quite available. I don't think we could do.
Yeah, I might move to a warmer climate for the apocalypse. I might, you know, before the whole apocalypse kicks in, I might head over to, like, you know, California or something. Or... Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, there's some, I know some people who prep, bro. I know some people out there in America. I've got some friends who have prepped, like, they've got vaults of weapons and, like, you know, my God, everything under the sun. It's like they've got the kind of house where if you were in, like, a survival game and you found it, it'd be like the best house. Like, oh my God, it's got all the treasure and all the loot, weapons and drinks and resources. Yeah, I'm not prepared at all. Like I said, I genuinely had this feeling at the beginning of 2020 that, like, this decade was going to be important, but I just didn't know for what reason. So, like, I think I've settled on, I'm just gonna keep trying to raise some level of awareness to the fact that this is all happening, you know. And, like, I've been lucky
as it might be, I'm trying to up the vibe, as the podcast is. I feel like
Well, yeah. Exactly, man. Like, you know, we've talked about some heavy stuff, but I think ultimately
up the vibe, but
but I think ultimately upping the vibe isn't going to necessarily always mean telling people something they will really enjoy hearing. It's more about kind of raising that awareness so that people become more conscious as human beings and become, you know, a little bit more open to a wider aspect of reality. And that does involve uncomfortable truths about, you know, global power and all this kind of stuff, but it also involves really expansive ideas about consciousness and the implications of reality and life in the universe. And, you know, the UFO subject really does fascinate me, and I find it also very, you know, frustrating. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship with that thing. But I have seen stuff, and I wouldn't say, like I said earlier on in the talk, I wouldn't say it's alien, like, in the typical sense. I wouldn't know. Maybe it is, but I wouldn't say to you, oh, yeah, no, that was the Palladian star brothers and star sisters. Like, maybe some people have been told that, but I haven't been told that. So I'm not going to say that shit because it's not what I know. All I know 100% is that there are things out there that respond to signals in the human conscious mind. And I don't know what they are, but they responded to very high energy, loving, positive emotion. That's what I was grounding my state in. And, you know, I think the hippies really have had it right the whole time about love and peace, man. Like, you know, I don't know why that's such a weird thing for us. Why is it so normal to see violence on TV, but having sex in the street would be a nightmare? We're a very strange human species, you know. We have this twisted perspective on what's acceptable. Violence, fine. Love, cringy, unsuitable, uncouth, you know, whatever. Especially in Britain, you know, we're a very sexually repressed country, Britain. We do it to ourselves. We're just very shy and, like, you know, kind of, it's weird, man. I think I've got more of the European blood in me in that aspect. But seriously though, it's not a normal thing to do. I don't really know why we do that. I know that, I don't know. I'm kind of like on a tangent.
There's a lot of odd things going on there. And you said about the Palladians and
Yeah, no, that was Somehow I went from Palladian Star Sisters to why we should all be having sex in the street.
And yeah, I know.
It's a bit of mental gymnastics. I'm sure that says something about me.
In terms of the Palladians, so when I hear like people like Grant Cameron, they talk in ways that make me feel like the phenomenon has changed in line with our own understanding. It was people from Mars, and then it became people from further away in Pleiades, or now they're different. They're coming from different dimensions or different time. So the phenomenon
where will come from next?
Where they're coming from next, but. From that perspective, you could say, well, then maybe none of it is kind of like concrete truth, but it's all kind of changing in line with our own. But then also I listened to some people like channelers, contactees, and one in particular I've had on her twice, Elena Denard. She's been really good, and she has supposedly a contact. And I do believe that she has a contact that in the that's out there that tells me that there are intelligent beings in spaceships orbiting Earth, and it's kind of crazy to think that that's happening. But what's your thoughts around that? Do you think there's some truth to what these contactees are saying about what's going on out there?
The annoying thing about channeling is I think it's 100% real, and I think that 90% of people are liars. That's the issue with it. Okay. Is that I think that, not necessarily liars, maybe that's a bit too aggressive. Misinformed.
I think there's a lot of opportunity for
truly wanting to believe something when it might not necessarily be what you're believing. I think that channeling is real. I just think that there's a lot of hucksters and hoaxsters and people that pretend to be stuff. And that's what ruins it for everyone. It's the same as CE5. I mean, the idea that I have managed to coax orange orbs to turning up over my house because of my mind is a ridiculous thing to say, and it is something that most people outside of these research fields would say is just not even worth believing could be possible. So I have to acknowledge that I myself I'm in a position very similar to the channelers. No evidence. Something incredible happened with my consciousness, and it was proof of another intelligence. It's all the same stuff as channeling. The only difference is mine was visual, not linguistic, right? I had a visual experience, not a linguistic experience or an inspirational experience. But I'll tell you something, mate. When I'm playing this thing over here and, getting into a real flow with it, there gets a point where I'm not thinking at all. Like not thinking where the fingers are going or what the chord's going to be. It's just happening. I'm just in some automatic flow state. I would call that channeling. And Nikola Tesla, he was channeling. He was channeling information and he knew it. The only difference is, where are you channeling it from? Is it the Arcturians and the Galactic Council and the Palladians, or is it from what we would call God? Is it the Akashic records, the universal index,
sort of higher consciousness in a way as well?
Your higher consciousness. So I think that there is a channeling. I just don't know if we understand what the actual channeler is to us. I think maybe we misinterpret it, or our bias kicks in and we give it a template and we dress it up. But I think that it could just be the universe. I think it's the universe is like a bubbling cauldron of information. It's just information, or data. Some physicists would say that it's just made of information. Everything's made of just inherently information, energy encoded with information, right? Mm-hmm. So if that's true, I would look at us as kind of like refined receptors. So you're constantly receiving information. So I think that when you're in a certain state, you just open up the funnel a bit more. You get a bit more in. And so very intuitive people, it's definitely, it's not exclusive, but it definitely seems to be something you can see very clearly with kind of like high functioning emotional intelligence and intuitive intelligence, not so much analytical intelligence. Analytical intelligence is very, very important, but it grounds you into this reality and it makes you observe the four walls around you. And that's basically what you have. What I see is what I am. What I see is what is in front of me. But emotional intelligence or intuitive intelligence is that other one, right? It's the abstract thinker. It's the one that goes, oh, but the walls are actually made of vibrating energy. And if I vibrated at the same energy as the wall, or maybe slightly faster, I could pass through it because it's not actually real. And nothing's actually real. And do I even know I'm real? Because when I dream, I think I'm in a real place. You know, that's abstract thought. That's like that. That's that kind of like intuitive abstract thought. And I think that that seems to lend credence towards having experiences with anomalous phenomena, having contact situations, and being more open to this kind of information, because you have the ability to look beyond what has been kind of told to you as normal. And very analytically minded people, not all the time, because Mackay, again, my friend, good friend of mine, and you know, I've had him on a couple times, I've said this about him, is that we're like almost two different parts of that. We're like two hemispheres. You know, I'm kind of like more the creative emotional intelligence, and he's more the analytical intelligence. So it's very interesting when we have conversations, because he's going, everything is a simulation. I think it's like an AI simulation. And I'm going, everything is a spiritual simulation. I think it's a spiritual simulation. And so we're both kind of the exact same opinion, but coming from different observational points. He's all analytics. So he looks at the basic physics of the universe and goes, it's a universe of information. It's a simulation. I look at my life and I look at all the weird things that have happened in it and all the kind of coincidences and synchronicities. And I go, the universe is talking to me. The universe is intelligent. There's a consciousness embedded within this. So we're both kind of like same perspective, but different observations. And I find that very interesting when it comes to channeling. And like, just to get us back onto what we were just talking about, is that emotional intelligence and very creative people, artists and, inventors, they seem to have a more open funnel for some of this information. And I'll end it with just this quote from Nikola Tesla, where he says, and it's, you know, it's one of my favorite quotes, where he says, my brain is only a receiver. In the universe, there is a core from which we gain knowledge, strength, and inspiration. I have not found the location of this core, but I know that it exists. And that, to me, has always struck me as powerful, because what he's saying as a scientist is, this is science. I'm doing science, but I know that this inspiration for this science, it's coming from something. I can't explain it. It's powerful. It's bigger than I can comprehend. I don't know where it is. I can't figure out that bloody coordinates for this thing, but I know it exists. I know it's real. That's faith. That's faith in the underlying spirit of reality. And Nikola Tesla is a brilliant scientist. Nobody should debate that. So you can be a brilliant scientist and still have a faith in the spirit of reality and recognize that no matter what you're doing, there's a spirit that's informing and helping and intuitively driving it. And that these things don't have to be at odds with each other, science and spirit. They don't. You know, you can be doing science in a spiritual realm. You know, and I think inherently we are in a spiritual realm. I don't really know what spiritual means, but I guess I just mean like it's not a computer simulation. I think it's a conscious energy.
For me, it's a case of, is the universe sort of a series of random events that we somehow are part of and we're just observing, or are we creating it for, is there a purpose? And I think right now it's hard to say what the purpose is, because I can't remember what happened before I was born, and I don't know what will happen when I die, but I do believe, I have faith that there is more to just this short period on this planet. And for that reason, I think there is purpose, and there is
I hope you're right.
Growth.
I hope you're right. I agree. I hope you're right. I mean, do you, I'm sure you do, mate, because you seem like it. Do you ever just wake up, or do you ever just, you know, just walking down the street and you're just like, what is being alive? Like, what is this? Like, why am I even? I sometimes have, it will stop me in my stride, and I'll just be like,
actually,
why am I observing anything?
I used to say, and this was actually going back to when I was probably a teenager, I used to say to myself, I am me. I would say it almost like the seventh or eighth time. Suddenly you have this almost infinitesimally small moment where this kind of like realization of what that actually meant happened. And it was so small, but it was enough for me to go, wow. in that kind of, and I think that spurred a lot of my maybe spiritual growth from an early age, in sense of understanding that just being an individual. It's not just about that I exist on this planet. It's about having an existence.
Just having
an existence. And what is because, that about? I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, like you said, we don't remember where we were before. So this is like, you know, I believe we probably came from somewhere, but for all respects and purposes, like, this is the first time you've been a conscious being, mate. Like, this is the first time me and you have been like a thing that's conscious. Like, just where was our awareness before it was here, you know? And like, that has always been something, I think, even from a young age, that's genuinely just niggled at the back of my mind. Like, you know, where was this thing that's experiencing this now? Where was it after, before this? And I just feel like my life I'm only 28 years old, not even that old. I already feel like I've had so much like nudging me going like, yeah, there's so much more. Like, there's so much more than just this little slice that you're occupying right now. You're here for whatever reason, but this isn't it. Like, this
that's where I guess my thoughts on the craziness of the world turns away from, oh my goodness, what's happening, to this is a gift. This is a gift to be here and experience it.
Yeah.
See it all unfold. It's to be
especially
at this time is actually a gift. Yeah.
It is a gift, and I'm honestly not trying to download any sort of white privilege guilt onto us, but it's also a gift to be, you know, in a privileged position, which we are, even just being Westerners living in houses. You know, we're in a podcast doing podcasts. You know, we're in a very privileged position to be able to speak to people and share ideas and have freedom in our time and not have to worry about, you know, literal day-to-day survival, like literal day-to-day survival, you know what I mean? So like, yeah, I don't think it's, oh god, it's such an unpopular thing to say, because if I say this, people be like, I've said it before, and I think it's true, that I don't think that we suffer through a lack of choice. Like, I think that our spirit understands why it's here. It wants to be here for a certain set of reasons. And if that reason is to live for 1 year and then go, that's it.
It's a controversial subject.
It's a very controversial thing, but I just feel like we can't understand the agenda of the soul. You can understand the agenda of the human, you know, me as a human being, but me as a human being, I don't think my desires are essentially the same as my soul's desires. I might, because dude, there's been plenty of things I've wanted in life that have kind of like been taken away from me, and I've been like, oh my god, and then it led to a healing process, or it was like a necessary thing. So it's almost like the soul has like a long game. The soul's got this long game process of where it wants to go, and you're the ego, the brain. You're also the soul, obviously. That's you, but you're also the brain, the human, the ego. And so like, there's like this battle between what the human wants, what the soul wants. And I think that's where people get it mixed up, is like, obviously all of us want to live forever, but hey, maybe my soul wants me to go tomorrow, mate. I don't know. You know,
You really think about the fact that you exist, and there's a potential that you exist might never not exist, there's both a liberation and a scary aspect to that, an infiniteness.
You're telling me. I think it fuels a lot of the fears inherent in society. Not consciously, but just subconsciously in the back of the mind of like the collective, is this dread. Like, we're just this little ball floating through fucking infinity, man. Like, there's no one else out there. Like, you know, maybe that's, and I tweeted this not that long ago, just a little thought, but I was just like, you know, it's not about them being our gods, but maybe we just need another species to be like, hey, like, you're not alone. It's, you know, we're all out here. Like, I don't know, like, maybe something so beautifully simple is what we actually need. Like a crying child lost, alone, and has no adults near it, and it just doesn't know what to do. And suddenly, you know, the adult steps in and picks up the child, and the child's like, oh, okay, you know, everything's better again. Maybe we're just a scared kid in the corner of space, man. Like, we're just this young little species.
when you believe that your entire existence amounts to what, maybe 70 years, of which, you know, 30 years might be in retirement in a home, and 30 years, you know, you're just struggling to get onto the ladder, and you just feel like, where is the opportunity for anything else? But if that's your belief in existence, then yeah, I guess it's hard to come across at the nature of reality in a positive way. But if you would start to take a step back and think of yourself as a soul in this infinite realm, and it's chosen to be here for spiritual growth, and you understand the reason why there is this sort of interplay of dark and light, of positive and negative, of a whole multitude of perspectives all around you, it gives you that flavor, flavor's not the right word, but a kind of an ability to view the world in a way that gives you some relief, that you and there's a conscious belief that you're having this gift and experience to grow, and it's not all doom and gloom. Yeah, it kind of changes the perspective, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that by the way, this has been a really fascinating conversation. We might have to cut it off soon, just because it's getting a little late. I'm really enjoying it, though, just to let you know, having a great time.
No, I literally coming up to the point where I was hoping to talk to you about the Giza and the Sphinx, because I have had a few conversations around that recently. Yeah. About
let me
that we can save that for another day, and just maybe...
No, I'm happy to do that now. I just really want to finish my thought before I forget it, man. Yeah. Because, you know, talking about kind of like dark light, and just before we get off onto the Egypt thing, you know, if we do come from like a sublime realm where it's like, you know, just light, then it makes sense that this realm is light and dark. It's the place we go to experience the opposite, to understand what we are. You know, if you exist in the sublime state of sublimeness in the sublime reality, then all you know is being sublime, right? Like, oh, I'm the light in the light of the light dimension. All I am is the light. I am the light, and that's what I am. Yeah. So you come here as a little light in the dark to understand you're a light, to experience being a light, to experience being, and I'm going to use controversial terms just because they're good terms to use for this particular thing, is experience being God. You are literally, instead of just knowing you are, like, oh, I know I am the light, now you get to experience the actual process of becoming the light, through navigating through the dark, right? And I think that this is where you have the allegories of, you know, I will not fear as I walk through the valley of death, and all this kind of stuff is it's knowing you are the powerful light. And yeah, you are surrounded in darkness, brother. It's a dark world, but you're the light. That's what you are. And that's what you're here to remember. And I think that's part of it. You know, I do think that's part of it. I think the spiritual people have got it right. I don't think anyone's got it completely right, but I think that's part of it, 100%. Mm-hmm. Come on, let's talk about Egypt before I go to bed.
I guess I've had people. I don't know if you've heard of Gary Osborne, who co-wrote with Jim Peniston about the Rhenishan enigma, but he took on the role, of just trying to understand the code that Jim Peniston said he received after he touched this unknown craft, and this was in the evening. So there's a backstory behind this, but this code, when it's in binary, and it actually gives a set of coordinates. And Gary Osborne has shown that potentially, in his view, this actually shows a link to the fine structure constant, thus proving that it's from, you know, maybe it's a future human, or it's advanced intelligence, but they're kind of like sort of stamping their intelligence on the message.
Well, didn't it say we are you? Didn't he get the like telepathic communication when he said, what are you? And they said, we are you, or something like that.
Although he hasn't really, I couldn't really pin Jim Peniston down. I interviewed him on what his belief this thing was. He didn't go down the ET route anyway.
Yeah.
But he had an experience, and from that developed what was potentially a discovery about connections with Giza and the fine structure constant. And I won't dwell on that too much, but so I'm talking to Rob Leland soon, who's someone who's worked with Robert Schoch, and I talked to a guy called Manu Sesfide. Anyway, they all believe, or they've all been part of this, I guess, alt history narrative on Egypt, on the Sphinx and who built the pyramids and on all this, which I'm very much part of since reading like Graham Hancock and people like that. So what do you think's going on? I guess is the question, under the Sphinx. Is there a Hall of Records? Is there more to be discovered?
Yes, there is a, no, I'm not, I was going to go off on some Gaia-esque diatribe of how I know everything about what's underneath the Sphinx, but no, I don't know. But I think that Egypt is profoundly powerful. I think that there is a real, ancient Egypt, you know, the pyramids, I think being there is a whole other thing, you know. I was very fortunate to be able to go out to Egypt and to go into the Great Pyramid of Giza without any public. We had the Giza Plateau shut down, and we had full access. And yeah, it's when you're in those things, man, I'm not gonna sit there and go like, oh, you know, I felt this incredible, like, but seriously, when you just like, you look at these things and you put your hands on them, you're like, oh, you're a profoundly powerful structure, aren't you? And you know, you go into these things and there's no hieroglyphs, there's no artwork, it's all just very precise engineering. This thing,
did you get a different energy inside? Did you have a different energy about the area?
I did in the King's Chamber. Yeah, but that was part of a whole ceremonial initiation type of deal, and that was certainly, I think that played a part in me feeling a different energy, was that I was being kind of like, there was a whole environment around it which probably made it even more pronounced. But I had one incredible, well, actually two, actually three, but one of them involved hash, so we'll leave that one out. The three incredible experiences in Egypt. Now, two incredible experiences. One, which was, yes, sleep deprived and hash induced, which, to be fair, are both shamanistic techniques, because sleep deprivation is a shamanistic technique, and obviously the use of hashish is also a shamanistic thing. And I did have a very interesting experience, like 3 a.m. on a boat looking out over a temple site on a mountaintop as the prayers in Arabic were echoing through the megaphones of the city, and I was sleep deprived and a little bit high, and definitely had a profoundly strong experience of being like pulled towards this temple and the prayers echoing, and that was amazing. But that was just, you know, that's not on the same kind of level as these other things that happened to me. But we were in, I want to say, Dendara temple, the temple to Hathor. I think it was that temple. And there was a statue, and this is the thing, right? This got me, because there were a couple of people who were always saying at every site, oh, I'm getting this profound feeling, oh, I'm getting it, you know. And I'm like this really weird spiritual guy. I'm like very skeptical of people sometimes, so I'm kind of like there rolling my eyes like, yeah, of course you're feeling the energy of Egypt, you know, like, ooh. But dude, I felt something in one place, and it was this statue of, oh, I've forgotten the name. I can't remember the name, I'm sorry. But it was a statue of this goddess, and it was in an area in this temple which people didn't normally go to. It was behind these big wooden doors, and they were closed. And I think our guide, Mohammed Ibrahim, who's a fantastic guide, by the way, so he basically said to us after the fact, oh, you know, I wasn't even going to show you that. We were not even going to do that. He went up to the guard and he, you know, spoke in Arabic, and he greased the wheels and got the doors open for us, basically. And we all got to go into this little room. And what's really interesting about the room, right, is that you've got these big wooden doors, and then you open it up and there's like a stone wall in front of you, and there's like a turning to go this way. So you kind of actually go in and then turn right to go down this narrow passageway, which then opens up into a small room with sand on the floor. It's completely dark, apart from one hole in the roof where the light is coming. I mean, it's so Indiana Jones. Like, this, the light is coming down from one point, lighting up this statue at the back of the room, this big statue. And I had been filming everything. I've been filming absolutely everything. I've been walking around like this through every site we'd gone to, just filming the whole thing because I wanted to document loads of it for the YouTube channel and I wanted to put loads of stuff out. So I was walking into this room like this, ready to turn around the corner and capture this statue. I come around the corner. I see the statue on the camera. Then I look at it with my eyes and then my camera just, then my arm just falls down to my side. And I just stare at this statue and get locked into it like some weird gravity well. It was very strange. I just started staring and I could feel like the intensity of something staring right back at me, man. And everyone in the room felt the same thing. It was so weird. When everyone came out, they were like, what's going on? I felt like that thing was just like staring into my soul. And I was like, yeah, I felt the exact same thing. And this was the first time I'd felt like anything in Egypt. I'd kind of gone out there hoping, oh, maybe I'll get some weird flashback or something. You know, nothing happened. But that happened when I went into that room and stared at that statue. There is a resonance to that thing. I don't know if it's what it's made out of. I don't know if they imbued it with some conscious intention when they created it, or if it's like an ET artifact. I don't know, but it's putting off an energy. It is 100%. There is an energy, at least, you know, as someone who was not experiencing that kind of thing out there, it was like, bam. And I just like couldn't stop. So yeah, that's an interesting one. And we also did see some weird flashing lights in the sky, like UFOs, at a really coincidental moment in the trip when we were on the tour bus coming out of the Saqqara Desert, just leaving the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid. And Timothy Hogan, the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, was reading a piece of Egyptian script about this saucer, this fiery disc that was coming over pre-dynastic Egypt from these official kind of like, you know, scrolls that he'd come across. And then suddenly we started seeing these flashing white lights in the crystal clear blue sky of the Saqqara Desert. One flash, two flash, three flash, four flash. So yeah, we saw that, which multiple people on the bus saw, and it's very hard to say what that was. Certainly not anything conventional. But Egypt, just to summarize and conclude, Egypt has a profound history spiritually, esoterically, alchemically, scientifically, mathematically, engineering wise. And I think that if anything, the pyramids, the Great Pyramids, are meant to be a time capsule through history that has information encoded into it. It has information about, I think, pretty incredible cosmic concepts and laws encoded into the engineering of the very building itself. It's a message. The actual structures are a message, and we haven't fully decoded that message yet. They may have other applications, but at the very least, it's some form of message through time from some builders that I don't think we really understand. Certainly not thousands of uneducated slave laborers. Certainly not that. Certainly not big ramps. I'm not saying aliens, but just certainly not the way we conventionally think the pyramids were built. It's got a special energy to it. Just got a special energy to it, man. It's a fascinating place. And I hope you get to go out there.
I'd love to go there. I've not been there myself. I was in Peru last year, went to Machu Picchu, and I did some ayahuasca, which I might talk to you about one day.
We'll have to get into that next time.
Yeah, maybe there'll be another time on that one. I haven't actually talked about that on this podcast, so yeah. Maybe that'll be my opportunity. But
well, I'm happy to, I'll
let
come
you go.
Back
I don't want to keep you too long.
No, I mean, if we'd started a bit earlier, I probably would stay on, but I've got to get a bed soon.
We could wrap this up because I think it's been fascinating. There's definitely more to touch on if we ever get another chance to do this. But I guess just to end, people can find you on the Project Unity site, and is there anywhere else, or
well, if you want to follow me on Twitter, where I'm 95% of the time informative, 5% of the time a bit of a douchebag, then you can follow me on Twitter. You know, I'll just be brutally honest, because social media brings out the worst in everyone, and it does occasionally bring out the worst in me. But yeah, I'm on Twitter, and that's at the Project Unity. YouTube channel's Project Unity. You can email me if you want to email me. That's at j.unity@protonmail.com. You can send me an email if you want to reach out, and yeah, thank you for having me on, man. I've really enjoyed it. It's nice because we went into a lot of different subjects, and that's what I like doing, because sometimes I don't know, sometimes people think you only have one thing in your wheelhouse, and you know, they treat me like I'm a vending machine for UFOs. Like, you know, you just press a number and I'm just going to blurt out some next thing. As I have a lot of interests, and I have a lot of, you know, concerns and a lot of things that I want to talk about. You've brought up a good majority of the things that I genuinely like to think about, but don't necessarily discuss as much, just because,
and as they say, it's all connected.
it is all connected, and not enough people really see that, and so they get upset when you try and bring in other things. And I think if people just see the bigger picture, they'll realize a lot of this stuff is intrinsically connected, and a lot of it just has to do with power. But yeah, really good talk, man. I had a great time. Would be happy to come back again. And I just want to thank you and all your listeners. Keep doing what you're doing, man. We need voices. We need voices.